From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In the parallel universes of American politics, two different issues are energizing candidates in the midterms. For Democrats, it's all about health care, and we talked about that extensively last week. For the Republicans, the rallying cry is around immigration, the migrant caravan, sending troops to the border, birthright citizenship. This hour On Point, immigration and the midterms, what candidates are saying and what voters want to hear. And you can join us. What immigration issues are on your mind ahead of the midterms? Are you going to be thinking about them as you decide where and whom to cast your vote? Is border security a big concern in your state? Tell us what you're hearing from your candidates, and what do you hope for? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, broadly speaking, President Donald Trump is the guiding force on how the GOP is talking about immigration this campaign season. And yesterday, he amped up attention by saying he'd like to end birthright citizenship via executive order. That came out in an interview clip released by Axios. Now, in that clip, the president incorrectly claimed that the U.S. stands alone in granting birthright citizenship, and then said he doesn't need a constitutional amendment to change that.
Now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
And again, the president is incorrect in saying that the U.S. is the only country that does this. At least 30 nations have birthright citizenship, according to the Center for Immigration Studies. And that's a think tank that proposes a harder line on immigration. Well, joining us now with more from Washington is Steph Kite, immigration reporter for Axios. She co-wrote the news story about the president's intentions, and we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Steph, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So first of all, let me ask you specifically, whom had Axios spoken to, or what had you heard from in and around the White House that made this seem like it was a good question to ask the president about his views of birthright citizenship?
My colleague Jonathan Swan has been chasing this story for the past several weeks, talking to some of his sources close to the White House, and it was not quite ready for publish. He still needed to kind of get that confirmed. But in preparation for the interview with the president for Axios on HBO, he decided he would go ahead and ask the president directly what he had been hearing, the tips that he had been given from his sources. And we were surprised to see the president quite directly and quickly answer that question and assure us that, yes, he is planning an executive order and had spoken to his White House counsel about it.
Okay, so planning an executive order, did the president say in any more detail about whether or not one is actually being drafted? Because it seems as if there's a lot of questions around whether or not this was the president saying it was something he wants to do eventually, or if something is in the works.
He did say that it is in the works. We did not get a lot of details about what that executive order would specifically say or do, nor did we get an idea about timeline yet. We pressed him on that in the interview, but he did not provide any further details. All we know is that it's something that he says is in the works, and he has doubled down on that on Twitter, saying that it is not in the 14th Amendment to cover immigrants who are here unauthorized, that their children are not covered by the 14th Amendment and do not automatically receive citizenship.
Right. That's the president's assertion, which, of course, many constitutional scholars disagree with. We're going to talk with one in just a moment. But I'm wondering, has Axios heard from any of its other sources, yours or Jonathan Swan's, that led to this question being presented to the president? Have those sources since then given you more detail about what specifically might be in the executive order?
We do not have more detail at this time. There still seems to be an ongoing debate as to whether the president can do this. As you said, the majority of legal and constitutional scholars say that this is not within the president's power. But there are a handful of conservatives who have argued not that the president has power to change the Constitution, but that the 14th Amendment leaves some wiggle room with regards to who qualifies for citizenship when they're born in the U.S.
Right. And in fact, just yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham tweeted that finally, a president willing to take on this, quote, absurd policy of birthright citizenship. And Graham added that He plans to introduce legislation along the same lines as the proposed executive order from the president, which I should note that Lindsey Graham tried to do something similar back in 2010. So among certain corners of the Republican Party, this has been a long-term issue. But I'm wondering if you got the sense at all that, I mean, the president was answering Jonathan Swan's question, but also we're just a couple of days out from the midterms, right? So could this be part of why the president answered the way that he did, even when there aren't more details forthcoming about what might be in the actual executive order? That, you know, this is a way to really get a lot of attention around immigration issues once again, just a couple of days before voting day.
That could have been a factor in his decision to answer that question the way he has. We've obviously seen him on the campaign trail making immigration a central issue ahead of midterms. So that is something that the president has campaigned on since 2016. It's something that has been important to his platform. But even within the interview, the president was not expecting that question from Axios, and we weren't necessarily expecting him to answer it so directly.
Yeah. Well, Steph Kite, immigration and demographics reporter for Axios, speaking to us from Washington. We have a link to her story on the president's statement about his desire to end birthright citizenship through an executive order. That link is at onpointradio.org. Steph, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's turn now to Akhil Amar. He's Sterling Professor of Law at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law. Akhil Amar, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Can the president, through executive order, end birthright citizenship?
No, and neither can Congress, with all due respect to Lindsey Graham.
But the president asserts that he can. So on what basis is he saying that?
On no basis that any competent constitutional lawyer would recognize. Constitutional law people disagree about all sorts of things. There is no person who teaches constitutional law regularly, whom I know and respect, who thinks that the president has a leg to stand on. There are people out there, but they're not constitutional law scholars. If this were ever litigated, it would be 9-0 in the Supreme Court, and pretty easily and obviously, because the text of the Constitution is clear, the history behind the text of the Constitution is clear, and the judicial case law is clear. 3 different cases, 2 in the 19th century and 1 in the 20th century.
Well, since you mentioned the text, the specific text in the 14th Amendment is all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Now, for people who are pushing the end to birthright citizenship, it is that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, that they're hanging their hopes on, making the argument that they don't believe that the courts, specifically the Supreme Court, has addressed the issue of whether or not undocumented immigrants are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States of America.
So let's just go through it carefully. I'll get to courts in just a minute. Let's just first ordinary language. If the child of an illegal alien commits some crime or does something, of course our laws apply to that person. They're subject to our jurisdiction. Let's now think about the deep historical background of that sentence, which was embedded first in a statute in 1866, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and then in the Constitution. The statute and the constitutional provision were repudiating a case called Dred Scott in 1857, in which the Supreme Court said blacks can't be citizens. And this says basically everyone born in America, black or white, male or female, Jew or Gentile, is a citizen as long as they're subject to the jurisdiction. And that goes all the way back for hundreds of years in English law to the rule that if you're born in England, you're an English person, no matter who your parents are, unless you're born to an occupying army behind enemy lines. That doesn't count. And then you're not subject to our jurisdiction. Our laws really don't apply to you if you're born behind enemy lines in an occupying army. Or you're the child of a diplomat, because in effect, if you're a kid of an ambassador, you're not really an American, even though technically maybe you're born technically somewhere in the United States, but you're treated as if you're born in your parents, the diplomat's home country. That's what subject to the jurisdiction meant in England for hundreds of years before the Constitution was amended in 1866. In America, one-third element was added. If you're born on an Indian tribe, which in a kind of an enclave, and that was eliminated. We don't really have strong semi-sovereign Indian reservations anymore, but that was the third American addition to this. That's what the Supreme Court emphatically said in great detail when the issue reached the Supreme Court in a case called Wong Kim Ark, and they went through all this English history. But now I'll give you the final pièce de résistance, the proof of this.
Just one second. So that by the way, that Wong Kim Ark's case was 1898, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yes. It's been far more than a century.
Yes, and it followed an earlier case that had said something similar, and it was followed up in turn in footnote 10 of a more modern case called Plyler versus Doe, building on all this. So the courts have really not been at all confused about this or in disagreement about this. But I'm going to give you now the key aha fact that proves all of this, you know, conclusively.
We've got about a minute before the break here, Professor Amar, but go ahead.
Okay. This was about making clear that children of slaves were citizens despite Dred Scott, which is basically people who descend from slaves can't be citizens. Some of the slaves in America at that time were technically illegal aliens. They had been smuggled into America in violation of congressional statutes saying you can't have the slave trade from Africa, but it did continue. There were some so-called illegal aliens, in effect. They were slaves in America. And by the way, we have slavery in America still, sometimes involving sexual slavery of people, you know, brought from China and other places. And their children, if they were born in America, were undeniably meant to be citizenized by the 14th Amendment, even though the parents technically were born elsewhere and technically had been smuggled into America illegally.
Well, Akhil Amar, stand by here for just a second because we do have to take a break. I want to ask you one more quick question before I fully let you go. Akhil Amar is Sterling Professor of Law at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law. And we're talking more broadly about immigration in the midterm elections. And we want to hear from you. What do you want to hear from your candidates about immigration at the borders, about undocumented citizens, about DACA, even about this birthright citizenship question? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about immigration in the midterms, and I'm speaking with Akhil Amar, Sterling Professor of Law at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law. And Professor Amar, I'm keeping you a few more minutes than I had originally planned, but I have two quick questions before I have to let you go here. One is that, you know, the president said to Axios that they are telling me, quote unquote, they are telling me that he could use an executive order to end birthright citizenship. It is not clear at all who the they are. I'm seeing a report here from Politico that has sources in the White House counsel's office. And one of the sources told Politico that unless it became a policy priority, they didn't want to spin their wheels for long periods of time, justifying the outer edges of authority for something that was probably going to be very inflammatory as well. I mean, do you know people in the White House counsel's office? Is it possible that I
do, and one of the lead people is named Emmett Flood. He happens to have been one of my favorite students of all time. I wrote a clerkship letter of recommendation to Justice Scalia on his behalf. He got the clerkship, and I think Emmett is a very sound person, and I can't imagine that he would disagree with me about what I said before. I haven't talked to him, but it would be very hard because there are rules of constitutional law. Another person who's also a student of mine, Stephen Engel, who clerked for Justice Kennedy way back when. I wrote him a letter of recommendation for Justice Kennedy, a brilliant student of mine. He's the head of the Office of Legal Counsel. They are the body historically tasked with giving legal advice to the executive branch of government. So those would be the two offices, and it just so happens that I do know the heads of, or at least top people in both of those departments, and I'd be very surprised if they disagreed with what I said.
Now, if it's even plausible that a change like this would happen, it would have to come through a constitutional amendment or some sort of three-fifths majority action through Congress, neither of which seem very plausible at this time. But you said earlier that you believe that if the president actually issued an executive order and legal action were taken against it and it made its way to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court would decide 9-0 against the president of the United States on this issue. Are you really that confident? Because I'm thinking about Justice Kavanaugh right now, who has, you know, in his own decisions on the D.C. Circuit, you know, espouses quite an expansive view of executive power.
And Brett Kavanaugh is an originalist. He's my student, and I testified on his behalf before the allegations occurred on September 7th of this year. And precisely because he is an originalist, and he and I play by the same ground rules, I'm a Democrat, he's a Republican, I'm a liberal, he's a conservative, but we play by the same ground rules. And this is, and the ground rules are, the text is the text, there is the history, precedent actually does matter, although in the end the text and the history matter the most, and it's just not a close question. I'd be shocked if Brett Kavanaugh thought otherwise, and your audience might want to read things that I wrote in support of the Kavanaugh nomination before the various allegations occurred, which we don't need to talk about and are not really the question of how Brett Kavanaugh thinks about the Constitution. And I think he thinks about the Constitution in a sound and sober way, paying attention to constitutional text, to constitutional history, and to landmark precedents.
Well, Akhil Amar is Sterling Professor of Law at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law, speaking to us today from New Haven, Connecticut. Professor Amar, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me. It's an important issue.
Well, let's hear a little bit from a key member of the Republican Party who disagrees with the president's view that he can change birthright citizenship through an executive order. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan yesterday in an interview with Kentucky radio station WVLK.
Well, you obviously cannot do that. You cannot end birthright citizenship with an executive order. We didn't like it when Obama tried changing immigration laws via executive action. And obviously, as conservatives, you know, we believe in the Constitution. You know, as a conservative, I'm a believer in following the plain text of the Constitution. And I think in this case, the 14th Amendment's pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And that would involve a very, very lengthy constitutional process. Mm-hmm. But where we obviously totally agree with the president is getting at the root issue here, which is unchecked illegal immigration.
That's House Speaker Paul Ryan speaking to WVLK in Kentucky just yesterday. Well, joining us now is Alan Gomez. He's joining us from Miami, and he's immigration reporter for USA Today. We have links to his reporting at onpointradio.org as well. Alan Gomez, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So you just heard Paul Ryan there saying that what he thinks the president is really getting at is this root issue of unchecked illegal immigration. And, you know, today, this morning, in the course of an hour and a half, the president pumped out 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tweets about immigration specifically. So how central is this as an issue to Republicans in this midterm season?
I mean, it's really become the issue. I think it started from Trump. He obviously, this is something that worked for him in 2016. It rode him to the White House from his first press conference announcing his presidential campaign. He was talking about Mexicans and which Mexicans are coming into the country and all that. And he rode that through to the White House. And so for him, he's just taken a page out of his 2016 political playbook and applying it to this midterm. And it seems like something that just kind of struck him just a few weeks ago, because it was really this caravan that really started it all. Since October 16th is when he really started digging in on this. That's just been a couple of weeks. But in that time, he has threatened to cut $500 million in aid to Central America, threatened to tear up the new NAFTA deal, threatened to seal the entire southern border, deployed these 5,000 military troops to the border, is considering suspending all asylum claims on the southern border, all for a group of migrants that's down to about 3,500 people at this point and is still about 900 miles away. So he started it, but the Republican Party has wholeheartedly embraced it. And they've been arguing this same tact. They've been taking the same tact for weeks now, and you see it in Senate races. You see it in local House districts that are far, far, far from the border. So it's really become a central component, if not the defining issue of their campaign.
And how much is it resonating with voters? Because when we talked about Democrats and health care last week, one thing that reporters from around the country were telling us was that voters wanted to talk about health care. Are we seeing the same thing about immigration with Republicans talking about it on the campaign trail?
Well, this has been the fascinating thing to see. If you poll all Americans, number one is healthcare, number two is jobs and the economy, gun policy is number three, immigration is fourth, and this according to a Kaiser Family Foundation poll. But if you only isolate out the Republicans, immigration is the number one issue. Mm-hmm. So clearly it's working for the target audience that they're intending it to. You know, immigration is what riled up, is one of the things that really riled up the base in 2016. And so after a summer where everybody was talking about this blue wave, about record numbers of enthusiasm when it comes to Democratic registrations and early voting and all of that, this is an attempt, and this is a way to rile up the Republican base. I mean, there's no working on the middle here. There's no trying to get swing voters with what they're doing right now. This is strictly an issue. This is strictly something that they're trying to do to rile up their Republican base and increase their turnout next week.
Well, let's get a call here. Let's go to Jay, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Jay, you're on the air.
Thank you. I feel like I'm a centrist here because I look at the immigration issue and I say, as a Democrat, I feel like it exposes the Democratic Party because it's so simple. We have illegal and legal migration, and the president, and I'm 50 years old, and for 50 years, we've been talking about illegal immigration, and he's trying to solve it, and it just seems kind of crazy. Meanwhile, I don't think it's a big issue, but I think it's a simple one to solve, and he's trying to do that. He obviously wants to change birthright citizenship, which should not be such a contentious thing. I mean, I'm a pro-immigration guy. I'm just a pro legal immigration Democrat. I believe in immigration. But I do think health care is a much higher priority for me and what I do. And I think that the Democrats and the Republicans both want to make changes, but there's so many entrenched interests, it's virtually impossible. And I think each one blames each other and nothing gets done.
Yeah.
The things that do get done are not productive.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for your call. Ellen Gomez, let me turn back to you on that, because one thing that Jay's comment makes me think of is Republicans are pushing hard on these immigration issues. I mean, advertising, in debates, on the campaign trail, in interviews. But are Democrats responding? Are they just simply trying to ignore immigration as an issue and focusing exclusively on health care? And does that put them at a slight weakness when it comes to dealing with, as you said, at least in Republican minds, the number one important issue for them?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, it's difficult for Democrats really to be arguing too much on immigration just because they've been in the minority in Congress and Republicans controlling the White House in both chambers. So it's not like any Democratic proposals over the last couple of years were going to go anywhere in Congress. So they're limited in that standpoint. They can't point to achievements. They can't point to anything that they've done in the last couple of years aside from play defense against the administration. But beyond that, they of course are talking about it as much as they can. But again, it's in this sort of this defensive posture. You know, the caller, Jay, described himself as a centrist there. He says it's common sense to fight illegal immigration. And so he supports the president's efforts to do that. But I think the Democratic message is difficult because they're fighting what has been just an unprecedented effort by the Trump administration in so many areas, mm-hmm. To limit both legal and illegal immigration. I mean, how do you argue against 5,000 military troops on the wall? And then the next day there's this news of the president trying to end birthright citizenship. And before that, we were talking about tearing up the NAFTA deal. And before that, we were talking about sealing the border. So it's hard, I think, for Democrats just to keep up with everything that the Republicans are throwing at them.
Well, I mean, the assertiveness on immigration is definitely, at this point in time, coming from the Republican Party. No doubt about that. So let's hear a little bit about how this is playing out on the campaign trail in Texas, because obviously there's that very high profile race between incumbent Senator Republican Ted Cruz and Representative Beto O'Rourke, Democrat challenger there. So let's hear a little bit about how Beto O'Rourke is talking about immigration on the campaign trail. Here he is at a CNN town hall on October 18th.
freeing dreamers, more than a million in this country, nearly 200,000 in Texas, from any fear of deportation by making them U.S. citizens here. They're already as American as anyone else in any way that's meaningful. Let's make sure that they're also citizens so that they can contribute to their full potential.
That's Beto O'Rourke on October 18th. Well, on October 19th in Fort Worth, Texas, Senator Ted Cruz took a much harder line. He told reporters that he does not think members of that migrant caravan should be allowed at all into the United States.
Look at this caravan. It needs to be stopped. It needs to be stopped with whatever resources are necessary, whether that is manning Border Patrol agents at the border or whether that is the National Guard. Nobody is allowed to lead a criminal enterprise and enter this country illegally. There's a right way to come to this country. Texas is a state we welcome, we celebrate immigrants, legal immigrants, but today's Democrats, instead what they want to see, like Beto O'Rourke, is open borders.
Senator Ted Cruz on October 19th. Well, joining us now from El Paso, Texas, is Julian Aguilar. He's immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune. Julian, welcome to On Point.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
Okay, so first of all, tell us how much in this Cruz-O'Rourke race, how much is immigration playing into what you're hearing from them on the campaign trail and what voters want to talk about?
I think it's playing pretty high. I think even before the announcement about the 5,200 troops to the border, and even the smaller number, 800. I mean, I think this is something that Congressman O'Rourke and Senator Cruz have been talking about, as long as they've been on the campaign trail. For Senator Cruz, one could argue that's as soon as he got to Washington in one capacity or another. But Congressman O'Rourke has always been very vocal about his support for the Dreamers being against the wall, trying to facilitate what he says legitimate trade and travel. He touts a bipartisan effort that he passed with Senator John Cornyn to increase CBP troops to facilitate legal trade. I mean, that was 3 or 4 years ago. It'd be hard to imagine anything like that would work in this political climate. But with respect to those clips that you made, I think that they're exactly what the two sides have been speaking about mm-hmm. for the last couple of years. And with respect to this deployment, I think if you were for Congressman O'Rourke, a week ago, a month ago, a year ago, and again for Senator Cruz during that same time frame, that this deployment isn't going to change your mind at all or isn't going to maybe make you rethink who you're going to cast a ballot for. That's if you haven't already cast a ballot. We're seeing early voting numbers are on record pace. But no, it's definitely playing in. And with respect to the polls and what Texans are thinking, the Texas Tribune and the University of Texas just recently published, or we're in the middle of publishing our week-long poll, and with respect to the biggest problems facing the country, Texans say it's leadership and political corruption. But with respect to the most important problem facing the state, Texans, by and large, say immigration at 21% and border security at 16%. Uh-huh. So this is still very, very high on the list.
Okay, so then tell us, what do we know about, or what have you heard from Texas officials, especially in border communities, about what they know about the troop deployment? Have they been in contact with federal officials?
No, with respect to what the Texas Tribune reported earlier this week on Tuesday, we did a follow-up with respect to more details, right? That's the natural follow-up. I mean, Texans are used to National Guard deployments, hundreds at a time, but they usually work behind the scenes. You can't really see them. They're engineers or they're helping build roads. That's what we've been told. But 5,200 troops to the U.S. border, I mean, you're talking about, Black Hawk helicopters, helicopter companies, concertina wire being, put up. I mean, this is something that's very unprecedented. So naturally, everybody's looking for details. You were able to see some activity in Brownsville a couple days ago, and CBP in El Paso, that's Customs and Border Protection, did some riot drills on one of the international bridges on Sunday. But with respect to actual details, how many troops are going to be in one location, what are they going to be their duties, who's going to be in charge? We reached out to congressmen up and down the Texas-Mexico border yesterday, and those that responded, their staffers that responded, pretty much said, we have a 1-800 number that we call in every day, and the information that we get is nothing more detailed than what has been already released to the press.
An 800 number. Okay. Alan Gomez, I mean, what do you know more? Have you heard more from anyone in the Defense Department about this, when the troops will be deployed, when, how, where, how, et cetera?
Yeah, so far we got a little bit of an update this morning from the head of Northern Command for the Pentagon, where they were saying that it's going to end up being about 1,800 active duty troops that are going to be heading down to Texas in the probably by the end of the week. They expect them to be ready to go. Then they'll start flowing into Arizona and California to get to that 5,200 number. Important to note that the general also mentioned that initially, you know, we talked about maybe 800 troops going. They announced 5,200 troops. And this morning he said it could go higher than that by the time this is all done. He said it will not reach 14,000. Which is, I guess, a report that was out there that he was trying to fight back against. But it'll be somewhere between 5,200 and 14,000 troops by the time they're done.
Wow. Well, we're speaking with Alan Gomez. He's immigration reporter for USA Today, joining us from Miami. Julian Aguilar also joins us. He's in El Paso. He's immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune. And we are talking about immigration and the midterms, how candidates are talking about immigration, what voters want to hear, and how important of an issue it is for voters as they decide what to do when they go to the polls. And we want to hear from you. Is immigration important an issue for you? Who are you hearing in terms of the kinds of plans or positions on immigration that you want Washington to take up? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about immigration and the midterms, and we're joined today by Alan Gomez. He's immigration reporter for USA Today. He's with us from Miami. And with us from El Paso, Texas, is Julian Aguilar. He's immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune. And we've got lots of listener comment coming here online. On Facebook, Mark First tells us, Paul Ryan said unchecked illegal immigration is the big issue. It isn't unchecked. Obama deported loads of people, and Trump continues to do it, albeit with very different tones. And then Mark says, the problem is not being able to agree on what rates and types of immigration are the most beneficial for the country. Well, let's go to Lori now, who's calling from Davenport, Iowa. Lori, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I am totally in favor of sending troops to the border, because I think we need to protect our borders. I think President Trump does not want any violence down there, but it's obvious that the people are getting aid somewhere. They have water bottles, they have food, they have money. Something is sponsoring this, and we need to protect America. And also, on another note, I believe in voter ID. I had to get one to get a library card. I have to have identification to get a loan, to open a credit card, to get a library card, to start utilities. There's nothing racist about it. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to do it. Why can't they have ID to vote, to show them?
Well, Lori, thank you so much for your call there. Alan Gomez, I mean, you hear Lori feeling very strongly about sending troops to the border and even about voter ID. So she's probably one of those voters that we were talking about earlier, who immigration is front and center, number one in terms of the issues they're concerned about.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, she mentions the idea that she doesn't want violence at that southern border. You know, that's an idea that we've been hearing a lot about from the president and from other Republicans who have been warning about this caravan. But I think it's important to provide some context to what these caravans are like. I mean, first off, they're coming into the they travel in caravans for their own security. Traveling by yourself or in small groups through Central America and Mexico is a very dangerous endeavor. So they've started forming these caravans years ago to just to make it there more safely. And the last caravan that got here, I think, provides a little bit of insight into what their intentions are. They arrived in April. There was about 500 of them that ended up making it to the border. About 122 of them were caught illegally entering the country, but 401 of them did exactly what they said they were going to do. They presented themselves at ports of entry and requested asylum. And from our reporters that we have embedded with the caravan moving through Mexico, it's clear that that's what's going on here. It's not going to be 10,000 people that arrive at the border. It's already shrunk down to 3,500. And again, they still have 900 miles to go. That's the equivalent of walking from Boston to Knoxville, Tennessee. So it's going to take a long time. And by the time they get here, it's going to be far fewer people and not exactly the kind of numbers that are going to be able to overwhelm or take over a U.S. port of entry.
Well, and especially with possibly the United States military there as well. But Alan, a little earlier in the show, and just clarify here a bit, but isn't the Trump administration also seeking to summarily deny asylum claims to anyone who makes them when they arrive at the border?
That is the last bomb we're waiting for before the election comes. This is something that they were talking about, that they were considering. They were planning a Tuesday rollout of this, but things got pushed back because of the Pittsburgh shooting and some of the other tragedies we've seen recently. But yeah, that is still a possibility. You know, basically they're considering using the same rationale that they used to implement the travel ban shortly after Trump took office. It was the first two versions of that travel ban were shot down by the courts, but the third one survived. And so they're looking at the legal rationale behind that one and trying to apply a somewhat similar argument to what's going on along the southern border to claim that this is some kind of national emergency, that it's a threat to national security, and thus the president should have the authority to at least temporarily suspend asylum applications. That will surely be challenged in court the second if and when he announces it. But yeah, that's one more thing that they could throw out here.
Right. Now, Julian Aguilar, you're there in El Paso, and I was wondering if you could talk to us about how this is playing out in a particularly interesting Texas congressional race. This is the one between incumbent Representative Republican Will Hurd and Gina Ortiz Jones, his Democratic challenger, right? Because that district that Hurd represents has many hundreds of miles on the border.
Correct. It's got about 800 miles of the Texas-Mexico border, and it stretches from far east El Paso County all the way to the outskirts of Bexar County, which includes San Antonio and Big Bend and several border counties in between. You know, this was considered a closer race a few months ago, but the latest polling shows that Congressman Hurd is, I guess he's a little bit more comfortable. That's not to say that Ms. Ortiz Jones hasn't posed a significant challenge and could still. You know, that's the thing. When people mention poll numbers today, they always go back to 2016 and say, well, you know, the polls were wrong then. So I think that's giving the Democrats and deep red Texas a little bit of hope. But Congressman Hurd also, you know, was very public about his the way he strives for bipartisanship. Mm-hmm. You know, he and Congressman O'Rourke, actually, they did that Facebook Live where, you know, D.C. was snowed in and they had to drive back to D.C. and they ended up doing the Facebook Live of their journey, which I think went a pretty good way for both of the congressmen to show that they are able to work together. And rural voters in Texas, you know, they're concerned about the wall and eminent domain and issues like border security, but they are also, by and large, a lot of them are frustrated at some of what they think is inaction. You know, you talk to ranchers all along the border, and they say, you know, they have to fix their fence or they have to call Border Patrol or people are going through their property. And that's not to say that they're not also compassionate and they realize, you know, that a lot of these people are just coming to work or to escape, you know, their home countries and to seek a better life. But they do think that something should be done about it. So I think Congressman Hurd, in the minds of his constituents, has done a pretty good job of trying to strike a middle balance. He's been somewhat outspoken, at least early on, about some of the president's policies. But closer to Election Day, he's he's obviously, you know, it helps him to go more toward the middle and stay in line with Republican values, but not to the, extreme end. And to Mr. Gomez's point earlier with respect to the caravan, he's absolutely right with respect to we don't know how many people are going to end up coming here. And what I saw on the bridge in Ciudad Juarez on Tuesday was migrants that were lined up at the port of entry waiting to get processed. So with respect to the caller's concerns and the legitimate concerns about who's coming into the country, if you're a violent criminal or you're seeking to come in undeterred, it's not likely that you're going to present at the port of entry, which is what a lot of people are definitely doing. Yeah.
You know, the Hurd-Jones race is interesting to me because Will Hurd has been, I think he represents, as you were saying earlier, how views of communities on the border are much more, they're more subtle and textured than we might see it as we get further and further away, actually, from the border. Because I know Hurd has been a very eloquent advocate for more smart wall technology versus hard wall technology between the United States and Mexico. But we got a lot of callers here, so let's go to them. Alan is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air, Alan.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for taking the call. I think this is just another case where the Democrats are willing to play defense and to play defense against emotional appeals and instead focus on just rational discussion. I think there's a lot of winning points that the Democrats have, and I think Beto O'Rourke brings some of them out. Surveys show that the American public favors permanent status for the Dreamers, some sort of permanent status. And I think the Democrats can make the point that immigration is solved, the problem with immigration can be solved through immigration reform rather than through posting troops on the border.
Alan, thank you for your call. Alan Gomez, let me turn to you. Is that what you're hearing from Democrats, or are we just hearing more sort of softer tones?
I mean, I think it's interesting the idea that he used the word emotional when it comes to the Democratic response, because it to some degree it has. There was quite a bit of fear over the summer with this abolish ICE movement that only a very small number of Democrats really truly embraced. But that became something that was slapped on everybody, every Democratic candidate. Ted Cruz is a Cruz better or rogue of embracing that. And that is one of the sort of that's a very good example where I think most people who talk about ICE, they're saying, no, let's not eliminate it entirely. Yes, we do have to deport undocumented immigrants in this country who are violent criminals, who have long criminal records. Let's just reform the agency, maybe fold it into something else. But then it all ends up focusing on abolish ICE. And that's a little bit about the emotions that we're talking about and how it can be pigeonholed into just sort of one argument.
Yeah. You know, we've been talking a lot about how immigration as an issue is playing out along the border here, but it does come up in debates further away from Texas and Arizona, for example, because we have some tape here of a debate last month between candidates for Virginia's 10th congressional district. Incumbent Republican Barbara Comstock says that she thinks that there's room to compromise when it comes to immigration issues such as DACA and border security. But then in this debate, she also made a point of bringing up her MS-13 bill.
I would like to mention my MS-13 bill to make sure we deport that in our system that we also don't have criminal alien gang members allowed to stay here. I put that bill forward. It's bipartisan. My opponent opposes it.
That's Republican Barbara Comstock in the race for Virginia's 10th congressional district. Virginia Democrat and current state senator Jennifer Wexton is challenging Comstock. And during a debate last month, she really hammered the GOP's immigration record. And Wexton claimed she'd do better.
There's been Republican control of Congress for years, and they've sat on their hands and put kids in cages. In Congress, I'll work for true comprehensive immigration reform.
Alan Gomez, let me just ask you about that quickly. I mean, Wexton referring there to the family separation crisis that we saw a little earlier this year. I mean, the Trump administration has moved or is planning or drawing up proposals that could lead to indefinite detention of families who cross the border here. Are those specific policy moves being discussed on the campaign trail, or is whether by Democrats or Republicans, or is it simply more sort of the hot button stuff that we've been talking about?
it's really everything. It's been stunning to watch this. In the Virginia race you were just citing, I mean, that's an example where MS-13 has been a problem in the Northern Virginia district that they're going for. The gang has committed many murders in that area, and so Comstock has rightfully been focusing on that. Wexton has also, you know, talked about it quite a bit. But it's amazing, as you move out to other parts of the country, just how much the specifics of immigration are being debated. Uh-huh. I was listening to a race in the Minnesota 2nd, where the Republican Jason Lewis and the Democrat Angie Craig, they're in Minnesota, over 1,600 miles from the border, and they're talking about the logistics of southern border security. Lewis is talking about visiting Smuggler's Gulch down on the border and what he learned from the Border Patrol there. The Democratic challenger, Craig, is talking about how drones and sonar technology is a better way to secure that border. And I was just kind of blown away hearing Minnesota candidates talking about the logistics of southern border security. And this plays out all over the country. In Idaho's 2nd Congressional District, the recent debate, the first 11 questions were about immigration. In Pennsylvania 17th, they talked about DACA, E-Verify, the family separations, the diversity visa lottery, this movement to abolish ICE, all in a district that is 1.4% Hispanic.
Wow.
It's just overwhelming how much this focus on immigration isn't just that kind of the generalized idea of this, you know, caravan coming this way. They're really getting into specifics in places where really immigration isn't that big, shouldn't be that big of an issue given the population and the low unemployment numbers there.
But on the other hand, a potential upshot could be that we're having meaningful and hopefully knowledgeable conversation about this issue in the context of the midterm elections. But Alan, I've just got a couple minutes here and I want to get in at least a couple more calls before I run out of time. So let's go to Sandy, who's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I apologize if there's any noise in the background. I just got to a toll gate, so I apologize if you hear anything.
Yeah, Sandy, go ahead.
Yes, so I wanted to just bring up the point that immigration is such a big issue as far as, you know, legalities and who can cross the border and why they're crossing the border. But something that I think that really resonates with a lot of younger voters like myself, I'm a millennial, and my mom was an immigrant from Korea, and the travel ban from the 60s affected her not being able to be born in America. And I've realized that when I tell people that my mother is an immigrant, they look at me and the first thing that they say is, well, you don't look like an immigrant. Mm. Or, you know, you don't look like the daughter of an immigrant. Mm. And that resonates with me because I'm like, why is that important? Why does it matter if I look like an immigrant or not? I've never been treated differently, mostly because I'm white and female. But my husband, who's Puerto Rican and is technically speaking more American than my mother was when he was a child, is treated a lot differently than I am.
Sandy, I'm going to have to take it back from you there and forgive me for that, which is because we're down to less than 2 minutes to go. But Sandy, thank you so much for your call. Julian Aguilar, let me turn back to you there. I mean, I think Sandy was trying to get at that. We have the political issues around immigration, but there are also longer term social and cultural ones. Is that something that's being discussed at all as you hear candidates make their closing arguments in these last days before the midterms?
Oh, sure, of course. I mean, people talk about the historical effects of what they saw as anti-immigration legislation there, which still exists, which still could fuel, you know, certain crimes or certain sentiments that are very volatile. You know, we've seen the last year, you know, certain statements and acts committed against specific groups. So I think people are obviously cognizant of that. But with respect to immigration, you know, being a nationwide issue, I think it, look at it like trade. You know, a lot of the border folks focus on trade because this is the entry point and it's a lot of their bread and butter. But the trade here goes everywhere across the United States. And I think the same thing applies to immigrants of whatever their national origin or ethnicity is. I mean, you have stories around the country about people being deported, you know, from Pennsylvania, California, from Idaho, from the all walks of life and all economies. And I just think that with respect to the immigrant labor, and I think that's why this phenomenon is so widespread across the country, mm-hmm. you know, and with respect to what the Democrats can do and the polls saying that most Americans do want some sort of status for the DACA folks, that's absolutely true. But what are the Democrats willing to give up in exchange?
Right.
Are they willing to give up funding for a wall-to-wall or for a coast-to-coast wall or for more enforcement? So I think that's the sticking point. They can agree on one issue, but they'll disagree on the other nine.
Well, Julian Aguilar, immigration and border security reporter for the Texas Tribune, joining us today from El Paso. Julian, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, with us today from Miami, Florida. Alan, it is always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And we've got links to both Alan and Julian's reporting at onpointradio.org. While you're there, send us a comment on what you think you're hearing about immigration on the campaign trail and what you want from the next Congress. That's onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.